Yeah, thank you for inviting me, and it's my pleasure to be here in Bristol. My mum and dad live on the other side of Bristol from the Wrecking Beacons in the same village as Badra. But I noticed that he didn't come to the Raise the Roof tea party that I had to come to. So I didn't see him this weekend. Anyway, more about that later. So I'm going to give a talk about just drawing on a few interactions that the Buddha had with kings. So you might know that he talked to everyone, the Buddha. He didn't really mind who it was, whether it was a courtesan or, you know, a lay person or a king or a queen or whoever it was. He was very happy to speak to them and to talk about the Dharma. And it's often thought that the Buddha didn't really think much about political matters, that that wasn't part of his remit. It's often thought that the Buddha operated in a more personal sphere on how the individual is best to overcome greed, hatred and delusion. So yes, the Buddha did operate in that personal sphere. But also, if we read the Buddhist texts, we also find that he was also interested in the social issues of the time, particularly when they did affect the development of the individual. So the first conversation that he had after his enlightenment was to someone called Ahunka Jati, who means basically huffing Brahmin. That's how it's translated, because he went around going to the Brahmin, dismissing everything that everyone said. Very, very arrogant. He went to the Buddha. Buddha's just got enlightened. He's just sitting under the tree, as he did for a number of weeks, actually, just absorbing his enlightenment experience. And the first person that he actually has a dialogue with is Ahunka Jati. And Ahunka Jati asked him, what makes someone a Brahmin? Now, this was a very, very loaded question, because the caste system in India wasn't really established at that time. It was just coming into being. So it was more of a sort of theory that was being developed and put forward, but it hadn't sort of really taken hold of society. And the Buddha was not a Brahmin. He was a Kshatriya. He was from the kind of warrior caste. And here was the Brahmin. So the Brahmins are the kind of top notch. They're born into a Brahmin family. They're the ones with the kind of religious knowledge and high status. And he says, what makes someone a Brahmin? And the Buddha said, well, it's by overcoming evil and realizing wisdom that one becomes a Brahmin. It's not by birth. It's by what you do, what you realize, what your actions are. That's what makes you great, in effect. That's what makes you a great person, a wise person, a spiritual person. It's not where you're born, it's how you act. And in doing this, he completely dismissed the Brahmanical system, this theory that was coming in, this kind of practice that was coming in about society being divided into separate castes by birth. So he was undermining basically the elitist social system of graded inequality. That social system that was going to come to do so much damage to India in the years to come, well, after Buddhism died out. So the first conversation that the Buddha had after his enlightenment was one where he challenged society's norms. And in fact, if you go to the Mahabodhi temple where the Buddha gained enlightenment, there's a great pillar set up to mark that spot. And the it's quite interesting sort of seeing the pilgrims there, because the Indians, that's second only to the Bodhi tree in their minds, you know, because it was the Buddha saying that he didn't believe in the caste system. So all the Indian Buddhists come and touch their head and offer great reverence to this pillar. And the rest of the pilgrims are completely confused what it symbolises. So they sort of come up and they put their bit of gold on it and their flowers as well, thinking, well, it must be important. But that is why it's important. So yes, and later on, after that meeting, the Buddha had a lot to do with kings, particularly Bimbisara and his son Ajatasattu, who were the kings of Magadha, and King Pasenadi of Kosala. And in a way, they're very beautiful meetings. They're very interesting because you have this contrast of the Buddha's spiritual power with the king's worldly power. And the Buddha in various ways gains their respect. They don't immediately give the Buddha respect, funny enough. He gains their respect. And then they seek for his advice in all their matters. So it becomes a situation where you've got worldly power seeking advice from transcendent power, the power of enlightenment, the power of overcoming greed, hatred, and delusion. And the kings know at that time that that is the superior power. And the Buddha advised him. He didn't kind of shirk away from talking to kings because, you know, that was worldly or somehow sullied power. He didn't see it as unspiritual to talk to kings. He was perfectly happy to talk to kings. And I think this is something that we could maybe learn from, because Buddhists in the West tend to want to keep Buddhism just in this private individual realm, like we've heard. And I think this is the advantage of Buddhist Action Month, is it's trying to say, well, actually it's not the individual personal transformation, is very much bound up with society's transformation, and in a way one leads to the other. So in a way, what we can also reflect on with Buddhist Action Month is to not let it just get caught into personal ethical actions, because I think that's also a tendency, that ethical actions in society in the West tend to be personal. Again, they tend to be about personal consumer choices. So this was very much reflected in our Tiratnaloka discussions about what we might do for BAM. And so we went through the things of, you know, let's not use candles. We could do a litter pick around the local reservoir. Then we realised we do that all the time anyway. I thought, well, we could just not use foil and cling film. I've got a thing about foil and cling film. They're terrible for the environment. We could do all this and that. And then I said, well, actually, I think what we should do for BAM is we should invite the local MP round, and we should tell him what we think the important issues are for us as Buddhists and his local constituents, even though clearly none of us voted for him. But he's in power. Let's go and talk to him about what his ethical choices is. I know his voting record, so I've probably got quite a lot to say. And the rest of the community, like, what? But they would say, well, that's not really Buddhist Action Month, is it? Because you'd have to involve all the local community, and they might think differently from us. I was thinking, no, that is Buddhist Action Month. We shouldn't necessarily make Buddhist Action Month about foil and cling film and candles. It's also about influencing society with our values. So there was I can't remember which one it was, there was a politician from the Green Party who says that those personal consumer choices are a great place to start, but a terrible place to finish. In fact, the government and local and big companies rely on us to make personal choices, ethical consumer responsibility, so that they don't have to take responsibility. Because if we're responsible to recycle our packaging, then they don't have to take responsibility for it. So the best idea that I've seen in the last month was actually to send back all unnecessary packaging back to Tesco's. Don't recycle it. In a way, they should be taking responsibility for having produced it in the first place. So I did think, actually, I might send all my toothbrushes back to Oral-B and say, or whoever the company is that produce them, and just say, actually, I think you need to find a better answer than plastic toothbrushes. And I'm going to send you my toothbrushes, my grim, toothbrushes that I keep for far too long anyway, and I would like you to do something about them. So yes, I think, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to actually look at the bigger questions, government policy, the policies of large companies, and really question them about what they're doing about the issues that we care about. So yeah, so the Buddha wasn't afraid to challenge the structure of society. He wasn't afraid to challenge Brahmanism itself. He was controversial. He was a controversial figure who did stir up society's norms. And what he did, in effect, was he created a new society, initially within his own Sangha. So he had a very different way of the monks and the nuns operating. You know, they didn't own property. they didn't operate by kind of worldly values and norms. There was no caste within the Sangha. So he set up this kind of new society based on different principles, fewness at once, no caste, no power or position. And that Sangha, that community of monks and nuns, had a real impact in India. So actually 80% of archaeological remains in India are Buddhist, which just gives you a taste of how much it spread over in India. Stupas everywhere, monks and nuns everywhere, living a very, very different life. And they gave a new ideal of how to live, a new ideal of a just society, and that ideal was taken up by Emperor Ashoka later on in the 1st century AD, who was the kind of great Buddhist leader in India. Anyway, I won't go into Emperor Ashoka on this talk, but if you ever want to, there's a Bollywood film. Which is quite interesting. He only meets Buddhism right at the end, after much wet saris and running around and songs and all sorts of things. It was his wife, incidentally. He was a Buddhist. Anyway, so I'll go back to what actually the Buddha advised kings. So there's some really lovely stories. I'm sure you're all familiar of King Ajatasattu going into the forest and becoming more and more afraid because he was wandering into the forest to go and meet the Buddha, and he couldn't hear him. And he said, well, there must be, they can't be here because he's with hundreds of monks and you'd hear them by now. And he thought it was a trap. He thought he was going to be killed. And in the end, he wanders into the forest and sees the Buddha sitting in silence with his monks, and he's so moved by that sight and by the discourse he has with the Buddha, he really wants to go for refuge. But unfortunately, he killed his own father, so there was such a tremendous kind of block in his conscience that he could never really, see the truth about the Dharma. Although he did then form a connection with the Buddha himself. I do also love the stories of the Buddha and King Pasenadi because I think they were friends, actually. I think they were probably a similar age because they talk about old age quite a lot. And in my imagination, they're sort of sitting, I don't know, by the Buddha's hut or in the forest or something, just talking about stuff that old men talk about, like old age crushing down on them like a great mountain. And sometimes King Pasenadi just comes and he just rejoices in the Buddha's merits or the Sangha's merits, and then he says, right, yeah, okay, I've got lots to do. And the Buddha says, okay, do what you think it's time for, and off he goes. I really love that the king would just come and rejoice in the Buddha's merits for no reason really other than to do that. What I'm going to focus on in this talk, though, is something that from the near the end of the Buddha's life in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And I'm going to try and give a kind of modern interpretation on it, which may or may not work. Anyway, it'll be sort of drawn from other ideas of the Buddha, and particularly drawn from the work of Dr. Ambedkar, because, yes, he drafted the Indian constitution based on Buddhist principles. So he's the only really modern, him and Sangharaksha, the only sort of modern Buddhist teachers I've seen anyway, who've really gone into how a Buddhist governance might take shape. What the Buddha had to say about actually ruling a country and organising society. So, you know, Dr. Ambedkar did a lot of work on that. So the backstory is, to this particular episode, is that Ajatasattu actually seems like he's in a really bad mood. And he decides he's going to just destroy the Vijayans. So the Vajians, I can't remember them. Vajians, sorry. So the Vajians were a republic. So you had these two great kings of Magadha and Kosala. And then you had the Vajians, who were a republic of different groups who sent elected representatives to a kind of council meeting where they would discuss things. So pretty much actually like the way our order is organised. So they were a democracy, they were a republic, and Ajatasattu, they became more and more powerful, and Ajatasattu got pissed off and decided to destroy them. But before he decided to go and destroy the Vidgians, he sent up his chief minister to go and talk to the Buddha. So the chief minister goes in his chariot to the forest of Rajgir. So he's living in Rajgir, comes out of the city, goes to the edge of the forest, and then walks up to Vulture's Peak where the Buddha is staying. So if you've walked up Vulture's Peak, it's not a small walk. I mean, it's totally doable, but... you know, it must have been quite a thing, actually. I don't know why, I just love this image of this king has to, this chief minister has to get off his chariot and walk up the hill to the Buddha. It was very much that he was going to seek the Buddha's advice. The king wouldn't have called the Buddha to his palace, which I think is interesting. It's a bit like Theresa May deciding to make her way to Addis Dharma. So unlikely. Mind you, she's so desperate she might just you know, drive to Addis Ababa, but then she had to kind of walk the rest of the way to go and see Sangharakshita. Or me, actually. Anyway, so Jatasati sends off this chief minister. Actually, he sends him off with his line. He says, ask him what he thinks about me attacking the Vijayans, because Tathagatas never lie, which is interesting. You know, in a way, you're a king. Everyone's lying to you all the time. Mm-hmm. So you want the one person who isn't going to lie. So he goes up and he asks the chief minister, asks the Buddha what's going to happen and what to do and what his response is to this particular idea. And the Buddha's standing there with his assistant, or his friend, really. It's called a secto. That's a terrible translation. Yeah, more like companion, Ananda. And he asks Ananda whether the Vijayans have fulfilled the seven conditions that he has previously laid out for them. And if they have fulfilled those seven conditions, then they can be expected to prosper and not decline. So I'm going to go into these with a sort of my own commentary. So, you know, don't take it as absolutely this is what it means. You know, you can reflect on it yourself. So the first one was to hold regular and frequent assemblies. So yes, the Vijayans were a democracy. They were a republic. They had different groups, chosen representatives from each group attending meetings. And the Buddha's first point is that they should do that regularly, hold regular and frequent assemblies. So I think the first point is, for a functioning society, you have to talk to each other. You have to find out what each person or each group thinks. You know, there's representatives from each group. Okay, what do people think in your area? And that takes time. It takes time to have a nuanced discussion with different groups. You can't just have a kind of snap judgment about what people should think or what they should say. You've got to be able to enter into what they are actually saying. And if it was true at the Buddha's time, it's definitely true today. I think we can have so many discussions that are based on very poor information and very kind of quick, particularly in social media. You know, there's a view you don't like, you half read it, you don't fact check, and then you put the little button on, whether it's a normal faces and whatever it is in between. And then that spreads, that gets shared, and then there's upset and polarisation. Even I've seen this in the order, in the Triratna Buddhist order. We've got our own order Facebook page, and sometimes something's on there and I think, well, apart from anything else, it's just completely untrue. Particularly when it comes to ordination training in Tivatna Loka, which is a subject close to my heart, and that's the only one they read. So then I think, actually, that's a bit off. That's not actually true. And I think what we can have on those social media sites is what someone called fossilised prapancha. Prapancha means those kind of mental loops that you have. You sort of turn something over and over again in your mind, and it doesn't go anywhere. And the thing about social media is that it can just... it's fossilised, it's there. Your own sort of little thought patterns, undigested thoughts are just there, and then they have an effect. And we say things on the internet that we wouldn't necessarily say face to face. So the first point here is, if you want to create a better society, actually talk to people face to face. And I think what we could probably do in Buddhist centres, particularly, is get more involved in the local community. This is one of my regrets, I think, about living in a retreat centre. It's very difficult to get involved in the local community because I'm on retreat so much. So it's a bit like everything that's on, I'm not there, or you know, I've got to be on a retreat. And also, the local community is very, very spread out, so there's not much on anyway. But yeah, I think we could get a bit more involved in our local community, particularly at this time when there's so much division. I think, you know, we're going to have to stand together as faith, different faith communities. Yeah, and talk to each other, regularly. Meet with the Sangha regularly, because I think that gives you also a strong basis of knowing who you are and what basis you're going to enter into discussions, so that you're acting collectively rather than on your own. You know, if you go into the local community with a particular voice, you need sort of one voice coming, well, this is, you know, from our local Buddhist community, this is our thoughts on this subject. I don't know. Going to your local mosque and saying, we just want you to know that we support you and we're here for you, sounds much better from the Bristol Buddhist Centre than one individual. So yeah, so in holding regular and frequent assemblies, it's also really important to act together and to meet with the Sangha. And the second one is to meet in harmony, leave in harmony, carry on business in harmony. So of course we can meet together in regular assemblies, but that's not going to do much good, and we won't prosper unless harmony is established. And of course this is the really tricky thing. I think this is the hardest thing, both within the Sangha itself and in local communities, because we have people with very, very different views. And how are we going to establish harmony with people with such different views? When Brexit happened, I was in the Sheffield Buddhist Centre, and it was really interesting because some people assumed on Sangha night that everyone had voted to remain, and they certainly hadn't. And so you had this kind of like sort of one half of the Sangha night being quite depressed, you know, because we just left, you know, just voted to leave, and some of them feeling quite sheepish and not really wanting to admit what they'd voted. So in the end, we just had to get people to talk to each other and say, look, it's okay, you know. Mm-hmm. And really not dismiss people because they think differently from you. And that was the kind of main job. And what we tried to do in that situation is to talk to each other and see what was underlying that decision for that vote. So I think what we have to do is we have to listen below the surface, if you see what I mean. Listen to what the real concerns are with people. Because actually, if you go underneath the surface, for example, of a vote, and you actually talk to people about why they voted or what their concerns are, what their fears are, you find you've got a lot of common ground. Actually, a lot of it was about a fear of the loss of community, a fear of loss of jobs, of stability in society. And we can all engage with those issues. Our strategies might be different, but we can all engage in those issues. And even if we think, you know, I voted to remain and other people voted to leave, and even if I think Brexit's a bad idea, I can still be in harmony with someone because I still have the underlying same values. It's just that I think there's a different way to express them. And of course we've got you know, the sad story of Jo Cox, but she has this wonderful phrase of what we have more in common than what divides us. And I think we have to believe that as practicing Buddhists. We have to believe that humanity is basically one, as Sangharakshita said, and come from that basis. We have to believe that we're taking part in the same society, that actually that society is one, that society isn't divided into different groups. And this is very much Ambedkar's thinking when he wrote the Indian Constitution. He said that democracy has to be based, yes, on these values of liberty, equality and fraternity, which he said is something he got from the Buddha and not from the French Revolution. And he's quite specific about what they all mean. But he said that fraternity underpins liberty and equality. You cannot have liberty, you cannot have a kind of freedom for people to choose their lifestyle, choose who they marry, choose who they're friends with. And you can't have equality where people have got the sort of same basis to start with if you don't have fraternity. And he said fraternity is actually meta. It's actually loving kindness and a fellow feeling with the same people in society. And he said it's meta that underpins democracy. Without loving kindness, without that feeling that you're all one society, that you're all brothers and sisters, you cannot have a functioning democracy. So if we're going to prosper and not decline, we have to act from the basis of meta, from that belief that humanity is basically one. And if we act from that basis of meta, that gives rise to sila, or ethical behaviour. Particularly ethical speech. So the Buddha talked about speaking words that are true, that are kind, that are meaningful, and that are harmonious. And that's what brings and builds harmony. It's taking an interest in someone, where someone is coming from, listening to them, getting underneath the views, because we care. And we care about them because on one level we love them, because humanity is basically one. So that's why we do the Metta Bhava, is so that we can cultivate harmony. So yeah, so that's the second one, is to meet in harmony, leave in harmony, and carry on business in harmony. And the third one is to proceed according to what has been authorized by ancient tradition. To proceed with what has been authorized by ancient tradition. So presumably, and this is Dr. Ambedkar's commentary on this particular one, he said this means that the Fijians had a democratic system and they should keep with a democratic system. I don't think it means that nothing can change from ancient tradition, because the Buddha would have definitely not gone along with that. For example, caste is ancient tradition and the Buddha didn't go along with that. And he developed a new religion. He was the founder of a new religion. So he's not saying that you just have to stick with ancient tradition. He definitely, clearly said that wasn't true. But I think what he was saying was to be wise about changes, be wise about what you're putting into effect in society. And in The Buddha and Karl Marx, which is a very important paper, actually, that Dr. Ambedkar wrote, he said the Buddha advocated a path of deep transformation and not revolution by force. He said it was that his deep path of transformation included listening to your elders, which we'll talk about again. And I think there's a beauty in that. There's a beauty in respecting tradition, particularly if it's a good tradition like democracy. And not just changing things too quickly because you want to make your mark. Of course, we can see that in modern society at the moment with particularly the Trump administration. What's the first thing he did? He just signed all those executive orders, undermining things that people took a long time to put in place, that took a lot of consultation and research and thought. And Trump just got rid of a load of stuff. As soon as he got in, to sort of, in a way, show his muscle. I think the issue that sort of reminds me of this is the NHS, you know, and at the moment we're in the welfare state. And at the moment, you know, the welfare state and the NHS are really under threat and are being privatised, sort of sold off to private companies. And if you read the front page of the NHS, the founding of the NHS and what it's about, if you read that front page, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. It says, you never have to worry about medical expenses ever again. We're going to take away that worry for you. And if you have a lot to do with India, you know that if you're poor, you die. You die because you don't have access to medical care. That's something I cannot tolerate because I was brought up with the NHS. You know, that if you don't have an NHS in a welfare state, if you lose your job, if you're ill, you just die. You just die in the street unless someone else looks after you. So reading the front page of the NHS sort of, I want to call it a manifesto, it's not quite a manifesto, but anyway, that paper, I just was brought to tears. I thought, what a wonderful vision. What a vision to create for society. Actually, it was created on the basis of people coming home after the First and Second World War, having fought for the country and having no medical care and begging in the street. So there's something really, really beautiful, and it's so quick to throw it away. That's what I realise. It's such a beautiful ideal, the welfare state and the NHS. And you can just get rid of it in an instant. Once you've sold that property, once you've sold off those trusts, that's it. You can't get them back again. So yeah, sometimes a rapid response is needed, but for real change in the way things are done, you need to take in people around you. We need to apply intelligence and understandings, an understanding of conditions, an understanding of history and why things are the way they are. I don't know if anyone's been listening to the Rees lectures by Hilary Mantel, but they're very, very interesting. And her point is basically you need a view of history to know, to inform the present, to know why you do what you do. And if you don't have that view of history, you're missing out on something. So Dr. Ambedkar said of the Buddha, he said, the Buddha's doctrine was to persuade people to adopt principles by persuasion, by moral teaching, and by love. He wants to conquer the opponent by inculcating in him the doctrine that love and not power can conquer anything. This is where the fundamental difference lies, that the Buddha would not allow violence, and the communists do. So this is a thing against communism. He said, the Buddha's way is a long way, perhaps some people may say a tedious way, but I have no doubt about it that this is the surest way. So the surest way is by persuasion, by moral teaching, and by love. It's not by the use of power. And the fourth point the Buddha made, he said, we must honour, respect, revere and salute the elders and consider them worth listening to. So, I should tell my dad that. but yes, I think it goes to the last point about looking at history, looking at your ancient traditions and seeing why they are the way they are. This one's about looking to the people in your society who are wise. It doesn't mean you have to do what they say, but it's asking you to listen. And I think, it's not just the Buddhist scriptures are quite nuanced about who the wise are, who the elders are. That it's people who've actually lived a life of ethics, who've lived a life of wisdom. And it asks us to listen to those people. I think there's another thing also, that in that society, the elders also step back, you know, and offer advice, rather than keeping trying to do everything. It was a kind of advisory role. But these were people who lived an ethical, upright life and could offer advice to the younger generation, which is something that we struggle with in this society, because there's a kind of cult of youth, that the youth know everything. Well, of course they do, but they might change their mind in the coming 50 years. And sometimes it's really good to just ask people who've been around a bit longer. I had a very interesting conversation actually recently with my father, because my father's I think my father's got a genuine vocation to tell the truth, and so he worked in newspapers all his life. And you might not think that the word truth and newspapers go together, but there's some people from the older generation that they did. In fact, he was asked to teach a course in King's about journalism and ethics, and he just blustered about it and said, well, there's no such things as ethics in journalism anymore when I was a lad, you know. But actually, I think there are genuinely journalists who wanted to go in and tell the truth, because where else are we going to hear about it? Do you know, where are we going to hear about what the government's really doing behind closed doors? You know, where are we going to hear about injustices all over the world? Well, I'm not going to go to the Yemen. I'm going to read about it in a newspaper or, you know, through a news source. So, yeah, so he's got a real vocation to tell the truth. And he looked at me and he said, you know, everything I ever worked for is being dismantled. He said, I thought as an old man, it's not cold, but as an older man, that I would leave the next generation in a better place than when I'd found it. And he said, everything we fought for is being challenged. Women's rights, workers' rights, education for all, religious tolerance. He said, all of this is being eroded in this society. And as he said this, he had tears coming down his face. And that really shocked me, actually. There's this idea that society will always get better. And maybe it won't. You know? Maybe we have to fight for that. Maybe we have to take up the same fight again and again and again. And if we do, we need to listen to the older generation. So yes, so number five, the fifth condition, is he said, and this is going to take a bit of explaining, which I'm making up myself, but it's do not forcibly abduct others' wives and daughters and compel them to live with you. So we all got that straight. No abducting of wives and daughters. If you were unsure about that point, we need to have a little bit of a chat. So there's loads of directions you could go with this particular condition. You could go into the women's rights and the Buddha and women's rights. There's an article by Dr. Baker, funnily enough, called something like, well, it's about the Buddha and women's rights. And and there's a whole question about were women's rights advocated by the Buddha? Actually, I'm not going to go into that hugely, because I think you can view this sort of negatively, as in what is prohibited, or you can look at it positively and what is the principle to be developed. And I think what the Buddha was doing was to asking the community to respect the liberty of the individual. And of course, he highlighted the individuals that were most vulnerable in society, which were women. So the Buddha was very, very strong on the fact that each individual needs the liberty to live out their own potential in life. He talks in another context about not allowing caste to define one's lifestyle. And as I said, the Sangha itself, the community of monks and nuns, was a casteless society. He said, as all rivers flow into the sea, just so all castes flow into the Sangha, and you can't distinguish between them. And he was fairly radical in that women could also join the Sangha, albeit after a little persuasion from Ananda. He categorically stated that women are also capable of realising the Dharma for themselves. And realise it they did. So there's great women, arahants, and teachers. It was clear that also women ordained women at that time and became teachers in their own right. And some of the earliest religious literature we have of women are the Songs of Awakening by the early Buddhist nuns. Dr. Ambedkar translates one of them by Metika, which I quite like his translation, where he says, "So sit I here upon a rock, and over my spirit sweeps the breath of liberty." So these are some of the songs of the early Buddhist nuns. They were free. They tasted freedom. They overcame greed, hatred, and delusion. And as they said themselves, the great dark was torn apart. So there was an image, a realization that all beings could attain that liberty, could attain that freedom. And he wanted that for all beings. So I think this point is really about respecting the liberty of others to live the lifestyle that they choose. He's asking us to treat people as individuals, capable of the best, choosing their own path, and not treating others as a commodity or an object that we can have or even steal. I mean, imagine stealing a person. And I think we can also take this as helping people to be informed, to make their own choices, and to build their confidence to do that. Even if it means that actually they don't want to be a Buddhist or they don't want to do what we want them to do, I think that's fine. I think in a way my job as an order member is really to help nurture people's confidence so they can make their own informed choices. But I think that it's also easy to dismiss the sort of more literal nature of this question in that we don't steal women anymore. Actually, that's not the case. There exists modern slavery of men and women, taken and held against their will, with false promises of and fear of violence. In fact, they reckon there's 46 million people around the world who are in modern slavery. And the Global Slavery Index, which you can look up, it's very interesting reading actually, says they reckon there are about 11,700 slaves in the UK. Many of those are sexual slaves, many of them are slave labour. And it says in the Global Slavery Index that most slaves are in countries that produce our cheap clothing, like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, China and Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan produces a lot of our cotton and they use slaves to pick the cotton, which reminds me of something else. So I think in this one we could also interpret it literally to not allow slavery in any way, which means that we are going to have to exercise consumer choice about where we get our clothes from. Fast fashion has a cost and it doesn't come to us, it comes to slaves, basically, in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, China, and Uzbekistan. So that is one area I really do think we could exercise consumer choice and put pressure on companies to have an ethical policy for their cotton and for their tailoring. So yes, the sixth one is to honour, respect, revere, and salute the Vijayan shrines. So that's interesting, to honour the Vijayan shrines, because presumably they weren't Buddhist shrines at that time. Presumably they were more nature shrines. What do shrines represent? The Buddha was definitely against superstitions and going for refuge to shrines. He said they won't help you much, shrines. So what was he pointing to in asking the Vijayans to honour their shrines? Well, I think what he was pointing to was that we need a higher value that is non-utilitarian. And just to kind of go from modern interpretation of this, because we don't have shrines so much. We lost our shrines, which I think is a great shame, except for in our village in Badra and my parents' village where a green man shrine appeared by the river. And people make all sorts of offerings to it anyway. But usually we don't have shrines. I think in a way our equivalent is art, because art is also non-utilitarian and represents higher values. Art itself offers us a chance to step back and get some perspective. And I think what's very dangerous in a government that's applying austerity ideology is that art can be the first thing to go because it's non-utilitarian, so you don't think it's not important. You know, it's easy to think that, you know, if you've got a hospital to support or an art gallery or a library, you're going to think, well, let's support the hospital because what does art do for anyone? Well, art does a lot for people. Actually, it makes us look at the bigger picture and in a way it shapes the direction of society. It makes us stand back and look at ourselves and wonder what our lives are all about. And even makes comments on society. You know, I think what we, you know, even in these times, you need a bit of satire, you need a bit of social conscience. This is what, of course, Dickens did, because he helped everyone identify and empathise with the poor and the dispossessed. And that changed opinions in society, because suddenly people were in that world, people who never would have been in that world were in that world. They empathised with those people, you know, people in the workhouse, people in criminal gangs, people in poor education. So yes, so maybe we could interpret this particular point about honouring our artists and writers, honouring the people who are doing something non-utilitarian, who are making something beautiful, or are helping us stand back and look at our society and look at ourselves. And we could ask them to remind us what is important, you know, which isn't just earning and spending money, but beauty and higher vision and feeling part of life. And I think nature also has this role. There's art and nature. And, you know, presumably the Vigean shrines were nature shrines. They would have been in rocks and trees and sacred groves and marking a place that was significant to people. And Sangharakshita says of this, he says it's really important that we believe that the universe is alive. Not just the universe isn't just there for us and our utility, but alive with the many voices that we can actually listen to us. Sangharakshita said, we must understand that life does not belong to us. We belong to life. So I think that's what he's calling us to do in society. We need that kind of non-utilitarian space. And I know you had Sahaja Tara here last week talking about paganism, and I think that's something that also paganism does, sort of, and really immersing yourself in nature, you suddenly see what's important. So the seventh thing is provision for the safety of arahants. So the highest value in society of all is enlightenment. So in society we need people who've seen the truth, or at least seen the truth to some extent, who freed themselves from the world, or at least freed themselves to some extent. We need those people to guide society into ethics, meditation and wisdom. And in looking at why this is important, we have to ask ourselves, what is it that holds society together? Well, it's not law, because law can only apply to a few people. And at specific times. Actually, it can only enforce values on the few. When Dr. Ambedkar talked about this question, he says it has to be a universal moral code, and only religion can provide that universal moral code, but it must be the right religion. And he said one of the reasons that he chose Buddhism is that it teaches prajna, it teaches wisdom, it teaches compassion, or karuna, and it teaches equality, or samatha. It teaches morality, and that's what's got to bind people in society together. If you don't have a shared system of morality, and morality for everyone, not just for people in the same religion as you, there's nothing that holds you together, and you're just dependent on law, which can only be enforced on a few. And he said, we've got to believe that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. So that's something that we can really think about. I mean, it's very, very obvious in India that Buddhism does help, as we've heard, in the social and economic uplift of people, as well as their, you know, religious uplift. But also look in our own society. Do we really think that this Buddhist centre is serving mankind? That the fact that this Buddhist centre is here and there's people practicing Buddhism, does that help serve mankind? And if we think it does, if we think that Buddhism really does have something to offer society, we need to support it. We need to support it by taking part, first of all, by coming to a Buddhist centre and by practicing the Dharma. But also, Dr. Ambedkar said, just to put it bluntly, you should give at least a fifth of your income to the Dharma. I think we could probably do more than that. But it's interesting that he said that quite categorically, at least a fifth of your income. And he was talking to the poorest people in India. Anyway, I'll just drop that in. But yes, it's giving the Dharma, giving the Sangha resources for them to use wisely. So anyway, the story ends that with the chief minister saying that since the Vijayans keep all seven of those conditions, they can't be defeated by force. And so then he says something so cynical. He then says they'll have to be defeated by propaganda and by setting them against each other. And sadly, that's what they did. So Jatasattu and the chief minister put in a plan of action over 3 years of sowing disharmony amongst the Vijayans, and the Vijayans were defeated. So there's a lesson for us in that too, that that's what undoes us. What undoes us is propaganda and setting people against each other. divisiveness. Interestingly, the Buddha's response to the chief minister is he didn't try and dissuade the chief minister. The chief minister then said, I'm going to leave, I'm busy, I've got much to do. The Buddha said, do what you think it's time for. But after he'd left, after the chief minister leaves, the Buddha turns to the Sangha and teaches them the seven conditions for the longevity of the Sangha. And it's sort of clear that's what he's primarily interested in. He's primarily interested in the continuation of the Sangha. In another place, he says actually to King Pasenadi, he says, the killer begets a killer, one who conquers a conqueror. The abuser begets abuse, the reviled one who is reviled. Thus, by the unfolding of karma, the plunderer is plundered. So I think from the Buddha's point of view, there's going to be plays of power. There's going to be a dance of power where the victim becomes the aggressor and the aggressor becomes the victim. And that's going to go on and on and on. He thought the real importance in society was the Sangha and helping the Sangha to grow and flourish. And I think in a way that's got to be the primary focus for us as well. It's interesting the sort of mechanism of that, because the Buddha talks to Pasenadi about the importance, they're just sitting around talking about the importance of good friends and how you can't really do anything without good friends. And then the Buddha says to King Pasenadi, he says, if you have them, if you have good friends, that's the basis, but then you've got to dwell in one thing for support. You've got to dwell in diligence in skillful mental states, in skillful states. He says, if you have diligence in skillful states, so if you have diligence in your ethical practice, that influences, first of all, your harem, very important. I don't know why that comes first, but you know, King Pasenadi had about 500 women. So it influences your harem, it influences your servants, your soldiers, and your subjects in towns and countryside. So what he's saying is that if you can exemplify ethics, that will have an effect. People will notice, and they'll start practicing the same as you. And I think Sangharakshita had similar ideas, or has similar ideas. He talks about the new society as practicing Buddhists who practice on the basis of ethics, meditation and wisdom, and they will have an effect on society. With good friends and ethical diligence, we can have an impact on others. But it is a slow path. Having an impact on others through one's own ethical practice is a slow path. It has to have channels. And I think that's what this seven conditions for the flourishing of the Fijians is really about. It's about those channels to help our ethical practice move out into the world. Talk to people, listen to what they have to say, respect traditions, respect history, respect one's elders, respect the vulnerable, respect beauty and the arts, and respect those who live as the highest.